The Catholic Church is pressing the Obama administration to scale back a new rule on birth control. The rule would require employers to provide prescription birth control as part of their employee health insurance plans. Religious leaders say the new requirement infringes on their religious liberty. As with many of these political issues that generate a lot of heat, the story may be more complicated than it seems. Turns out many Catholic universities and hospitals already provide their employees with prescription birth control. Those that do not are technically in violation of a different federal law. NPR's Julie Rodner reports.
The new rules for covering contraception, which spring from last year's health law, do have a religious exception, but it's a narrow one. It doesn't cover most religious-affiliated universities, hospitals, or social service agencies. That puts organizations like the Catholic Archdiocese of Washington in an untenable position, its chancellor, Jane Belford, told a House subcommittee last month.
We're talking about whether us, as an employer, would be required to provide coverage for something that we teach is morally wrong.
Belford said the Archdiocese health insurance doesn't currently cover prescription contraception or sterilization, and the new rules violate the Archdiocese's ability to simultaneously obey its religious dictates and provide health coverage.
Until now, federal law has never prevented religious employers from providing for the needs of their employees with a health plan that is consistent with the church's teachings on life and procreation.
But that's not exactly true, says Sarah Lipton Lubid of the American Civil Liberties Union.
Institutions like hospitals and universities, you are required to include contraception coverage in your insurance plan where you include coverage for other prescription drugs as a matter of basic gender equality.
That's the result of a ruling more than a decade ago by the Federal Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. It found that employers whose health plans offer prescription drugs but not prescription contraceptives violated the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, a 1978 civil rights law aimed at women in the workplace.
That's because prescription contraception is a form of health care that is unique to women, and the consequences of the inability to be able to access contraception, those fall primarily on women.
Now, the EEOC ruling isn't technically binding unless employees take action. That happened recently when some faculty members at a small Catholic college in North Carolina filed a discrimination complaint. The EEOC ruled in their favor. But it may help explain why dozens of Catholic universities and hospitals already offer contraceptive coverage as part of their health insurance. More than half the states also have laws that currently require it, with varying levels of religious opt-outs.
We've always had contraceptive birth control included in our health care benefits. It's something we've come to expect for ourselves and for our family.
Michelle Michaud is a labor and delivery nurse at Dominican Hospital in Santa Cruz, California. It's part of the Catholic Healthcare West system. A spokeswoman for the 40-hospital chain confirmed that it's offered the benefit since 1997. Michaud, who was raised Catholic but doesn't practice now, says she doesn't see any problem for a Catholic hospital to provide a benefit that conflicts with the church's teachings.
Oh, no, because they don't just employ Catholics. I mean, they may be Catholic, but who they employ are not necessarily Catholic.
That would include people like Andrea Waters. She's the assistant manager for legal recruitment at Georgetown University Law Center. It's another Catholic institution that offers contraceptive coverage to its employees. Waters is 26, Presbyterian, and lives with her boyfriend. She says she didn't even realize that birth control might not be covered when she first took the job.
And then I was talking to a coworker, and they had said, make sure you go over your health insurance plans because some Catholic universities don't cover birth control.
What the Catholic Church's leaders are now seeking from President Obama is a broader exemption from the new rules, which would let them not offer or stop offering contraceptive coverage. They have the strong backing of Catholic members of Congress, like Pennsylvania Republican Tim Murphy.
The foundation of our nation is not to impose laws which restrict persons' ability to practice their faith.
But Sarah Lipton Lubid of the ACLU says this isn't a fight about religious liberty.
What the bishops and their allies are asking for is the ability to impose their religious beliefs on people who don't share them.
A decision by the administration on the rules is expected soon. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
All right. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, you talk back to us. You've been letting us know how you feel about some of those stories we've brought you this week, and we'll give you those comments, a sample anyway, as well as some updates in just a few minutes. But first, it's time for Faith Matters. That's the part of the program where we talk about matters of faith and spirituality. Today, we want to take a look at a number of developments affecting members of the Catholic Church in the U.S., and frankly, people who are not Catholic. For example, regulations issued in connection with the Obama administration's health care overhaul will require insurance plans to cover contraceptives for women. The mandate does allow for some religious institutions to opt out, but it doesn't cover many Catholic universities, hospitals, and charities, which, as I'm sure most people know, affect many more people and serve many more people, including people who are not Catholic. The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, which is the official organization of the Catholic hierarchy here, call this rule, quote, an unprecedented attack on religious liberty. Here to tell us more about this, along with other news, is Michael Sean Winters. He is a writer for the National Catholic Reporter. He's also a fellow with Catholic University's Institute for Policy Research and Catholic Studies. He's with us once again. Welcome back. Thanks for joining us once
again.
Good to
be here, Michelle.
So let's start with this issue of exempting religious institutions from parts of the health care law. Could you just please lay out for us, as briefly as you can, what's at the center of this debate?
On August 1st, the Department of Health and Human Services issued new mandates of what has to be covered in insurance plans. And among those procedures that have to be included are contraceptive coverage, sterilization, and some drugs, morning after pills that are the church considers abortifacients.
Mm-hmm.
The conscience exemption from those was exceedingly narrow, and it doesn't include most Catholic organizations because it said those organizations were exempt if they primarily only served co-religionists, and Catholic schools serve many non-Catholics. Catholic hospitals take everyone. Catholic charities serve everyone. We don't in the Catholic Church, we don't help the poor because they're Catholic. We help them because we're Catholic, you know, as Cardinal Hickey once said.
Right. So the restriction would apply to institutions whose primary constituency, if you will, are people who share the same religious background. And the bishops are upset because their institutions, like hospitals, universities, and
exactly.
schools, serve people from many more diverse backgrounds. But, you know, dozens of Catholic hospitals and universities currently offer contraceptive coverage now as part of their health insurance packages. That's part of the administration's argument. Here's a clip of a nurse at a Dominican hospital in Santa Cruz, California. Here it is.
We've always had contraceptive birth control included in our health care benefits. It's something we've come to expect for ourselves and for our family. They may be Catholic, but who they employ are not necessarily Catholic.
You know, what about that argument? There are other religious groups who have a similar issue, like the Salvation Army, for example, which, as many people may or may not know, is a religious denomination.
Right.
But most of the people they employ don't adhere to that faith. And so they
right.
are, you know, in the world. They obviously operate under their own, you know, allegiances within the denomination, but they don't have the same requirement of those they employ who do not share their faith. What about that argument?
Well, I think there's two parts to this. One is it is true that at the state level, certain state laws mandate contraception coverage, and the church works out an arrangement at the state level. That doesn't mean that we're just going to say, well, then we might as well have it at the federal level, though. It would be like saying, you know, the Republicans took the governorship of Pennsylvania and Ohio, so the Democrats should give up the governorship of New York. That just doesn't make sense to me. And what's different here, obviously, is this is a federal mandate, not a state mandate. The second part of that is, you know, every club gets to set its own rules, you know, and in the Catholic Church, we don't take referenda on these rules. And so the church is pretty consistent on some of its teachings. And I think that served the Catholic Church pretty well over time, but we don't take a poll. I mean, we know from looking at the polls, many Catholic women do use contraception, but that doesn't mean that the church endorses it. And I think the hierarchy looks at an issue like this and they say, you know, attitudes change for reasons that no one can foresee, but we're not going to give up what we think is the truth just because a poll says that our people are not with us
that. No, but I do have to go back to the question that you just raised, which is this: if the Catholic Church is willing to negotiate this matter on a state-by-state level, why isn't that an appropriate guideline for how this issue is navigated on a federal level? Why isn't it? I mean, if it's simply a matter of first principles and core principles and is non-negotiable, Why can the Catholic Church negotiate these matters on a state-by-state basis?
And I think the history of accommodation between church and state, and not just in this country, but every country in every century, is always kind of complicated, and people try to make accommodations. But then there are these moments, and this is one such moment, where all of a sudden, and I think here it's because it's happened at the federal level, people do start engaging the first principles that are involved here in a way that if you're just the local bishop and you're dealing with, you know, a state official in California, it may not dawn on you that there are these kind of underlying concerns. So I think there's a bit of a tipping point argument here.
Well, how do you think this is going to – what are the next steps here to look for as how this is – how this issue is to be resolved? As you know, the Obama administration is also under pressure from its, you know, core Democratic constituencies who feel that it is absolutely essential to hold the line. The core principle for them is extending health care coverage, particularly for the things that people need and want the most, to as many people as possible. They say that's their first principle. And as we discussed, the Catholic bishops have issued some very strong language in opposition to this. What's the next step in this conflict, in this conversation?
We're all waiting for the president to make a decision. He did meet with Archbishop Dolan, who's the Archbishop of New York and the president of the Bishops' Conference in November. And after that meeting, Archbishop Dolan said that he thought it went very well. A source told me that the president told him the Archbishop and the other bishops would be very pleased with his decision. That then produced this counter-reaction, and you've seen a lot of pro-choice and women's organizations who come at the issue very differently. You know, I was speaking to a woman who's a member of the pro-choice caucus in Congress, and she said, you know, I'd feel differently if there was a conscience exemption for Viagra. You know, and it is a shame, I think, that this issue has come up in the context of contraception coverage for a variety of reasons. But I do think at the end of the day, the bishops are on pretty solid ground in saying, you know, we built these institutions. Why are you trying, you know, now you people like the ACLU who are defending the wall of separation between church and state can't jump over that wall fast enough to tell us how to run our schools.
Except that these institutions also receive, you know, federal support and federal dollars and tax considerations because they serve communities beyond their own. I mean, there is that also part of the argument.
Although that's actually not part of this issue because this is universal mandate under the Affordable Care Act.
All right. So to be continued, clearly there's more to cover on this.
We're waiting.
Okay. We're talking with Michael Sean Winters of the National Catholic Reporter. We're talking about a couple of important stories in the news that affect Catholics and others. This is fascinating to me. This past Sunday, some Catholic parishioners began implementing the new English liturgy. Let's listen to Reverend Chester Snyder of St. Joseph's Church in Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania, run through the new version with parishioners.
Let's practice it. The Lord be with you.
And with your spirit.
Lift up your hearts.
We lift them up to the Lord.
Let us give thanks to the Lord our God.
It is right and just.
You're pretty good at this.
Well, that wasn't part of the liturgy. But this is Michael, explain kind of what's the news here.
This is a new translation of the Mass. I think one of the confusions is some people say, oh, because it's the object of this new translation was to be more faithful to the Latin. There's a sense that somehow we're going back to the pre-Vatican II Latin. That's not the case. What's being translated here is the post-Vatican II Mass in Latin. This is not a retrenchment to the old Mass at all.
So what's the criticism? What's the pro? What's the con? I hate to put it in such crude terms, but what's the pro and what's the con?
I think the pro is that the language is more elevated and certainly more faithful to the Latin. I mean, this was much easier for the Spanish and the French because their languages were closer to Latin. And so now I would say that the English is actually going to be much closer to the English into the Spanish and French translations. And in this country, you know, bilingual masses are going to be the wave of the future. So that would be the pro. The con is the other language was a little bit more accessible. And the critics would say it was more pedestrian and that's not appropriate for a liturgy. And people were familiar with it and everybody likes, you know, things that are familiar.
What do you mind if I ask your opinion about this? I know we invited you here as a reporter to give us the to tell us what the news is. But do you mind if I ask your opinion? On the one hand, I can see the point. I mean, that some people think that the whole purpose of making the language more accessible, which was the whole point of Vatican II, which is to bring people closer to their faith so they could really understand what was being said and develop that deep connection to it. Yeah. And then others say, well, the whole purpose of the liturgy is to be lofty, to create a sense of transcendence, something bigger than the self and the day-to-day. Of course, it also, I have to say, does do away with all the gender. No more of this gender neutral. It's pretty much he.
Right.
No doubt about that. What's your take on it? Do you mind if we
ask? You know, I usually go to a Latin mass, and so I haven't really been paying that much attention. But no, I did last Sunday actually go to a mass, and the people you just played in that tape were much better than the congregants where I worshipped at the University of Maryland. I actually think it's a great opportunity because, you know, take some of the words that have been cited as clunky and unhelpful. One of them is ineffable. God is now described in the liturgy as ineffable. And people say, well, people don't know what ineffable means. And I said, well, then we have to do a better job teaching people who God is, because understanding that he's always greater than our preconceptions of him is a pretty essential component to it. And so if they don't know what ineffable is,
but aren't you teaching people what ineffable is as opposed to what God is? I think that's the core of the argument. But isn't really a grammar and
explain God without using the word ineffable. That's a pretty important thing to know about him. You know, another one of the questions is the word consubstantial. Now, this is a translation of the Greek homoousios, and it was the central debate at the Council of Nicaea in 325. You know, it's worth revisiting that debate. It was an important debate. We have a kind of cultural remnant of that when someone says it doesn't make an iota's worth of difference. In Greek, it was homoousios versus homoiousios. There was an iota in there. But it matters whether or not you think Jesus is God or whether he's just a lot like God. And in 325, it was many bishops were heterodox. And it was the people of God who said, well, wait a minute. If we're praying to Jesus and he's not God, are we idolaters?
Mm.
That's worth reteaching our people.
So these are things that are worth learning in your
Absolutely.
View. All right, that's one view. That's Michael Sean Winter's view from a guy who goes to a Latin mass voluntarily. Thank you, Michael Sean.
The music is better.
Thank you, Michael Sean. Michael Sean Winters is a writer for the National Catholic Reporter. He's also a fellow with Catholic University's Institute for Policy Research and Catholic Studies, and he was with us here in Washington, D.C.
Military chaplains fulfill a lot of roles. Yes, they conduct religious services for members of the military, working at home or in war zones, but they also serve as counselors, helping troops deal with the complicated questions surrounding war. The large majority of military chaplains are Protestant Christians, and they're supposed to support all troops, no matter their religious affiliation. But our next guest says military chaplains aren't addressing the introspective needs of military atheists. Jason Torpy is the president of the Military Association of Atheist and Free Thinkers. He's been working on getting the military to bring in some atheist chaplains. Jason Torpy, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks a lot. I'm glad to be here.
So you have since left the military. You were deployed to Iraq in 2003. Did you ever have any personal interactions with a military chaplain? Did you seek guidance or advice?
Oh, of course. All the time. You know, my organization really supports what the chaplains do while they're there. And especially in the last 10 to 20 years, they've acquired a lot of secular responsibilities, essentially counseling, retreats, family counseling, marriage counseling, deployment counseling, suicide counseling. And a lot of those responsibilities, you know, right or wrong, has been put on the chaplains. And to the extent those chaplains can attend to a faith-based solution to that for those who share that chaplain's faith, that's fine. But for any given chaplain, that's likely to be a small portion of the population, even for Christian chaplains. So I point the finger at them not because they're always the problem, but because they are the solution.
Can you give some examples of circumstances where, as an atheist, as a humanist, you felt left out?
Going on a military mission, for example. You know, we were getting ready to roll out, and everybody come in. So as the commander of this convoy, everybody come in. We're going to do a prayer first together. We're not going to talk about communications. We're not going to talk about route planning. We're not going to talk about first aid. We're not going to talk about maintenance. So I had to opt myself out of that situation, to out myself, because this commander took it upon himself to have a personal religious activity in the midst of a military mission.
You didn't participate?
No.
How did you walk away from that?
Well, as a captain, there's a lot fewer people that can tell me what to do. Now, the person that was in command was a major, so I was still, you know, stepping outside. He was extremely unhappy about it. He said, oh, you know, why are you creating trouble? I said, you know, why are you creating trouble? Why are you excluding me from this activity? This is a military mission, and I support your right to pray. But right this second, we have a military mission, and for you to use your power to pull everyone in to do a Christian prayer is wrong.
So why atheist chaplains? This may be the obvious question, but why not just push for more secular counselors? Why is it important to have an atheist in the chaplaincy, which you think of as a religious group.
There are individuals that they don't have those traditional religious perspectives. And some of those individuals want to serve as officers in the military. That's how they want to serve the nation, to do chaplain work. And they can do that in a way that Christians can't do it. So if you replace humanist chaplains for Jewish or Muslim or Hindu chaplains, the objection is just as invalid. You say, these people believe differently than I do. How could they help everyone? Service
members. But that's how it is now. There are chaplains who are Christian or Buddhist or Jewish,
right,
and they're expected to minister to everyone.
Well, minister is not the right term. They're expected to support everyone. And that leap to ensure that they have the training to understand us and to ensure that chaplains are required to stock our materials and provide facilities and support to provide for our community, just as they do everyone else, that is the leap that the chaplains have not been able to make yet.
What do they say? What's the pushback?
Well, essentially they say, well, we're not saying no because we want to support everybody, but we're also not saying yes either. One note also, it's important to understand this in historical context. Chaplains in 1775 were established by George Washington to give Protestant prayers to troops. Fast forward 200 years, essentially. And in 1992, the first non-Christian, non-Jewish chaplain was a Muslim chaplain. More recently, Buddhist chaplains and Hindu chaplains have been added. The chaplaincy is extending their diversity, but it's only in the last 20 years. And this last thing, again, once you add monotheists, polytheists, pantheists, and once they extend to non-theists, the chaplaincy will have embraced all of the service members and the breadth of life stances and deeply held personal philosophies. And I really hope they can do that.
That's Jason Torpy. He's president of the Military Association of Atheists and Freethinkers. He's been speaking with me from our studios in Washington. Jason, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
With 4 weeks until the Iowa caucuses, we're that much closer to the possibility of a Republican presidential nominee who's also a Mormon and a former leader in the church, Mitt Romney. We're joined now by Joanna Brooks, who writes about Mormonism and her own experience in the church, both for Religion Dispatches and her own blog. It's called Ask Mormon Girl. Joanna, welcome to the program.
Guy, thank you for having me.
So this election has been, you know, dubbed the Mormon moment, right? You've got Mitt Romney is obviously very viable. John Huntsman, not so much, but he's also, you know, a Mormon. Both of these guys are very visible. Would you say there's something to that idea, that this is a Mormon moment in politics?
Well, it's certainly a moment when Americans are coming to grips with how little they know about Mormonism. The best data we have tells us from the Pew Center that about 50% of Americans say they know little or nothing about Mormonism. So a lot of the questions people have tend to be fed by sort of sensational coverage or misunderstanding.
If Mitt Romney does become the Republican nominee, I mean, it's only fair to ask questions about his background, his faith. He's not just a Mormon. I mean, he was a very important figure in the Mormon church in New England, right?
Well, the church has an entirely lay clergy, and Mitt Romney served as a congregational leader known as a bishop. There are 30,000 Mormon congregations worldwide, 30,000 bishops. Hmm. It is fair to ask questions about the culture of leadership Mitt Romney was raised in and that he assumed as a young man in Mormonism, both in terms of the networks of power he's associated with and the way he was raised as a Mormon to think about what it means to be a leader.
How do you think it would be reflected in his handling of the office?
Well, I think we see it already in his, I'm not the first to observe, his stiffness in terms of interactions with the public. Given that Mormon congregations don't openly dispute with their leaders, they are not used to perhaps candid feedback. So that lack of an ability to do a give and take with the press or the public is something we've already seen impact Mitt Romney's candidacy. And I think it may have been something he picked up in Mormon leadership culture.
Presumably, there has to be a great deal of pride as well. I mean, Mitt Romney, if he is the nominee, will have broken some new ground. I mean, this has got to be something that many Mormons are also excited about.
Yes, people are rooting for Mitt Romney, but at the same time, there's a white knuckling as sticky issues from the Mormon past are brought into public examination.
Sticky issues like what?
Certainly the historical practice of polygamy and its continuation in Mormon theology. Mm-hmm. Race is a sticky issue in Mormonism. Americans who know something about Mormonism are broadly aware that the church did not admit men of African descent to its lay priesthood from the late 1840s through 1978. The church has never been entirely forthcoming about the reasons behind the ban. Maybe many members aren't even sure for themselves. Gender roles within the church's involvement in anti-same-sex marriage politics has been an issue of controversy as of late. And again, that's something that will need to be addressed during the Romney presidential campaign.
Let's say Governor Romney becomes a nominee and wins, becomes the president of the United States. What then with the discussion about Mormonism? Does it continue? Does it end? Does it get worse, better?
The White House coffee maker won't get much use with President Romney in the White House. There might be a Book of Mormon in addition to a Bible on the bedside table. You know, they'd see an LDS president attend church in his local congregation, celebrate Christmas in the White House. I think that having a Mormon as president would put in public light Mormon day-to-day life, and Americans would discover how very normal most Mormons are.
Joanna Brooks, thanks.
You're welcome.
Joanna Brooks writes about Mormonism for Religion Dispatches and the Ask Mormon Girl blog. She joined us from San Diego.